The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, is Reese Davis.
Playoff statements were made. Others took a major hit in their quest to make the college football playoff. This is the College Game Day podcast for Monday, November 14th. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here. Our custom is to record this podcast on Monday morning, and we will certainly spend a lot of time talking about what happened on the field throughout the course of this podcast a little bit later on. But everything in college football and everything in sports, in fact, at the moment as we speak, is being overshadowed by the tragedy in Charlottesville on Sunday night, in which a former University of Virginia football player is the suspect of a shooting in which three people were killed, two others were wounded. The first to be confirmed killed is a current Virginia football player, and the tragedy is unspeakable. The pain that they're feeling in Charlottesville and across college football for this senseless act of violence that, you know, we all have become way too accustomed to seeing. And Pete, you know, so much of this, we love to talk football, and sometimes you fall into the trap of making these players X's and O's, and their families, and they're critiqued and criticized for performance. And then something awful like this happens, and none of that matters, and all you can think about is the devastation being felt within that community and within the families of those affected.
Yeah, Reese, obviously just an unspeakable tragedy. And again, as we are taping this on Monday morning, and again, I just want to reiterate that by the time some people listen to this, because obviously podcasts don't come out aren't consumed in a linear way, you know, there'll be a lot more details, and we'll update midweek when we can. The former Virginia walk-on Chris Jones is armed and dangerous and still on the loose right now. And I bring that up more to just have an empathy for the entire Virginia campus. I mean, you have an entire campus in lockdown right now. You have a team that's dealing with a tragedy. The Charlottesville paper, The Daily Progress has reported that Deshaun Perry, a 22-year-old linebacker and defensive end, is one of the three people who was shot at the Culberth Garage. I mean, just it says here he made two tackles against Pittsburgh on Saturday, and now his family is flying from Miami. And just my heart just is ripped out. Obviously, for his family, the families of everyone affected, Carla Williams, athletic director there, Tony Elliott, the head coach there, it's just an unspeakable tragedy that's you know, still ongoing as we talk on Monday. So just for the sense of uncertainty and just fear, it's just really a difficult time there. So our hearts and prayers go out to them.
They're looking into the background, obviously, and the reports are starting to, have been coming out over the last several days. And the suspect, you know, was listed on the roster, didn't play, been a few years ago. And I think that according to the article that I've started to read here, that he's still listed as a student at the University of Virginia, at least according to this article. As you rightly said, more details are going to come out. And this is the type of thing in which leadership within the team and within the athletics community and on the campus is vital. It can't be prepared for. There's no way that you could expect Tony Elliott or Carla Williams to know precisely what to do in this situation. But the one thing from knowing about both of them is that I think they will, you know, they will make really good judgments in terms of being the strength, being the backbone for the players and the athletes and the students at the University of Virginia who've had their sense of safety completely rocked and undermined. And, you know, it really speaks to the ongoing issues in our society with mental health and with evil and with all of the things that confront everyone, but seem to particularly be confronting young people and how they deal with temptation and pressures in life and different things, and when they act criminally or violently, as it is alleged that the former player, Chris Jones, did. Whenever that happens, I mean, certainly in my judgment, that is worthy far more of punishment than any empathy. But then when you take a step back and look at society at large, you try to get at the root of what is motivating people to behave violently and in such a callous fashion toward other people, and what, you know, what can be done about helping people handle things in a more productive and certainly less violent and horrific way than what's been manifested on so many places, not only on campuses and in sports, but across the way. And certainly in the state of Virginia, they are acutely and painfully aware of this, with, you know, Virginia Tech had the horrific murders that happened several years ago. And that's something that is still part of the fabric and the culture in that campus right now. And you see memorials and tributes and remembrances anytime you go to Blacksburg. And there have been other issues away from the University of Virginia that have happened in Charlottesville over the last few years. And then this one is, it just breaks your heart. It breaks your heart to see it.
Yeah. I don't have a ton more to add, Reese, other than just, extreme empathy. They obviously play Coastal Carolina on Saturday. And the games just don't matter right now. There's really no other way to say it. You know, what a difficult moment for that university. I know class has obviously been canceled today. There's a shelter in place that was put in last night. Just what a difficult time for one of the great schools in America, right? One of the great public schools in America, just a wonderful place filled with wonderful people. And they're just really confronting the just the most unthinkable tragedy this morning.
Yeah. And we hope that the perpetrators are apprehended, stopped, and a sense of security and safety can be returned to everyone in the town of Charlottesville and on campus or on at the University of Virginia, and that sense of security, which everyone should be entitled to in our country, is restored as best it can be and as quickly and efficiently as possible. Our thoughts and prayers going out to everyone who's been affected by this, and certainly that will be affected by it as news continues to come out about this tragedy at the University of Virginia. We'll be right back after this to talk about what happened this past week on the field in college football on the College Game Day podcast.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Back on the College Game Day podcast, Reese Davis and Pete Thamel, and certainly our excitement over talking about what occurred over the weekend has been tempered dramatically by the tragedy that has unfolded in Charlottesville, Virginia. As we mentioned at the top, we recorded this on Monday morning. More details will be coming from various other sources. But in the meantime, there, certainly a lot of things happened on the field over the weekend that have great implications. Pete, you and I were in Austin for the TCU-Texas game. And on Saturday night, that game did not unfold in any way, shape, form, or fashion the way anyone suspected. I had one of our producers mentioned to me after on Sunday afternoon, did any of our guys mention that this could have been a defensive struggle? And I was like, no, because no one expected it, including Sonny Dykes and Steve Sarkisian. So, you know, I think the thing I came away with, there were a couple of things. One, TCU really answered the bell in terms of being challenged. 7.5-point underdog, people expecting the patented Sonny Dykes fade that we've sort of joked about over the years, where Sonny's had a lot of teams over the years. And maybe it was because he maximized them early. A lot of reasons for these types of things that have faded down the stretch, and many expected that it would start on Saturday night. Instead, TCU came out aggressively. Their defensive front just whipped Texas's offensive front. You know, couldn't get Bijan Robinson going at all. And I thought that there was a lot to like about the way TCU responded. That's the more important story because of the grand scope of what TCU is pursuing. I think another part of that is, what does it mean for Texas, who most certainly did not answer the bell on Saturday night? And here they are with another minimum 4-loss season once again. And certainly, you know, they've had some tough games, tough breaks that they came up short, but they came up short again. So let's start with TCU. They won a different way. And the committee had talked about complete team and all of that. Well, that's a different way to win. And I think it puts them in really good stead and keeps them in the mix if they win the Big 12 championship. And even if they were to stumble, say, against Baylor or something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was to go to Austin and just completely stone that Texas offense. I mean, that Texas offense, I think the first quarter combined was the worst offensive quarter in FBS football this year. That's what they said, some note like that on the broadcast. So just completely antithetical to the Big 12, completely antithetical to two offensive coaches, you know, who've made their living calling plays. You know, you have two of the higher profile quarterbacks in the country with Quinn Ewers, who really seems to be struggling right now, and then Max Duggan. Nobody could move the ball. Nobody could figure it out. Nobody could pick up a first down. So, you know, a lot of credit to TCU for sort of adapting and adjusting, figuring out a way to grind out a couple drives. And really, Joe Gillespie's defense, the 3-3-5 stack, they did not have D. Winters, a great linebacker, for the first half because of a targeting penalty. Mm-hmm. And they just made play after play. And Texas couldn't do anything. Bijan Robinson, I think, only had 12 carries for 29 yards. And Texas just couldn't get anything going, which is stunning. Now, I know they're young on the offensive line. They have issues at right tackle. But like, Texas football should not just be swallowed whole on offense like that. And I want to say that the last two second halves of the prior two games, they didn't score a touchdown. Mm-hmm. And obviously they didn't score an offensive touchdown there. So it's a 5-alarm fire for that offense right now. They're just simply not getting it done and not moving the ball. And there's myriad reasons for it, but it's just, it's been a bizarre disappearing act considering some of the flashes that they showed early in the year. And Bijan Robinson is one of the 10 best players in all of college football. And it's been a little bit of a mystery to me why they just haven't been able to get him going. But I don't want to dwell too much on Texas's struggles. No, because yeah, TCU created them. Joe right. Gillespie's 3-3-5 stack. You got a freshman nose guard. You've got ball hawk defensive backs. They wreaked havoc and chaos. Sark, as a play caller, has struggled against that style of defense in the past. And boy, did those show up again on Saturday night. So, I mean, they basically TCU took the committee's biggest criticism and answered it resoundingly on the biggest stage with game day there in sold out DKR in one of the more hostile environments TCU is going to play in an intense rivalry. And they said, oh, we can't stop anybody. Looks like we can stop somebody.
So we've talked about this before, Pete. You go watch a game from the sideline. Typically, you go to the visiting sideline as long as mm-hmm. the sun's not glaring right in your eyes on that side or something like that, because it's less crowded over there. Mm-hmm. So I was on the TCU sideline Saturday night and was told a great story about Josh Newton, who, you know, played his tail off in the secondary for TCU, too. He transferred from Louisiana Monroe. And the difference in the amenities and different things that are available to players sure. at the highest level, you know, it's not no fault of Louisiana Monroe, but, you know, Josh had talked to some of their people about that previously they had gone to restaurants sometimes, like to look for extra foods. Hey, are you guys throwing out any food? There's a lot of football players doing this to make sure they got their calories, you know, bulk and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he came in and made it a point to thank all of the people at TCU. You know, it was very moved by the fact that basically whatever he needs from a nutrition standpoint, food standpoint, scholarship standpoint, all of the different things that had really not only changed the way he's able to pursue his goal of being the best football player he can be, but it's also helped his family at large. You know, he's from Monroe, Louisiana. So you hear stories like that, and you sort of get a picture of how some of the teams are put together sometimes, and how you can find, and I don't mean this as a pun in any way, shape, form, or fashion, but a hunger to be great, an appreciation, an opportunity to play your best on the biggest stage, because there is an appreciation. There's a, there is a desperation because of what you've been through to get to that point. And maybe there's a little bit of that in a lot of places on the TCU team. Duggan gets a lot of attention because it's never easy when a veteran quarterback and a leader doesn't win the job under the new coaching staff. That is a recipe for malcontents, except Max Duggan was bigger than that and ends up getting the job back after Chandler Morris got hurt, which has been documented 1,000 times. But I thought it also showed a little something that flies under the radar about the appreciation from some other guys on that team, and maybe a little bit of insight into where that passion that TCU is playing with right now is coming from. That, you know, that it's not all about five stars and hopping in the transfer portal and getting your best NIL deal. There are also some dudes out there who are getting after it because they feel like they recognize that they've got a tremendous opportunity in front of them, and the passion with which they play on the field is reflecting that.
I think that's a really good point, Reese, because there's a lot of demonization of the portal and NIL because it's, you know, it's not familiar to people and it's not the way they grew up with the sport. But boy, what opportunity it's yielded guys. You know, like you hate to say it, but essentially, if you're at a high-end Big 12 school like TCU compared to Louisiana Monroe, which is a low-end Sun Belt school, that's almost like a different. It's almost like a different level of sport. It's like going from AAA to the big leagues within college football. And I do think one of the aspects that gets overlooked is that nutrition aspect. For years, remember the old NCAA wouldn't let you put cream cheese on a bagel. The biggest criticism to me, the biggest crime to me that the NCAA, which is committed plenty of, did was like limiting how you could feed athletes. Like, are you kidding me? You're making these kids work 18 hours a day. You're running them around the country, and then you're not letting them put food in their bodies for energy. Like, and they're going to go to McDonald's and, you know, use their per diems and their stipend checks and whatever. And they're going to buy the cheapest food possible. And so I just really think, like, those, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the waterfalls and the leather lockers and all that stuff. Like, elite nutrition, especially in a program that's a developmental program, is such, you know, is such a foundational element. And I go in all these buildings like you do, these football programs, and like, there's huge spreads, breakfast, lunch, fuel stations. Thank God for that development. Mm-hmm. Like, what an important step in just taking care of the athletes that is. And look, the training table is different at TCU than it is at Monroe. It is what it is. You know, it's just basic. It's just basic finances. You know, it's like the difference between going to, you know, Mastro's and Longhorn Steakhouse, right? Like, it's just, there's just a different level. And you know, for kids who want to go pro, you need to gain those 15 pounds of muscle. Plus you got more strength coaches, more people to work with you personally. And the guys who don't have that early in their college career are going to, you know, have a strong appreciation of that. So I've really come to appreciate the opportunities of the portal more than the drawbacks of the portal. And that's a great story that, you know, that illustrates that. The one other point about the TCU defense, before I kick it back to you, Reese, is that, look, Gary Patterson was celebrated and put on TV a bunch. We talked about him on game day. We talked about him on the podcast. Let's just be really clear. Like, TCU hit a rut under him, and Sonny Dykes and Joe Gillespie, especially, that defense wasn't stopping anybody Gary's last couple of years. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so there has been a spirit I talked to a couple coaches who studied TCU going into the week, and like they just said, they play so hard. Like that is just something that's very difficult to quantify, but that was what really jumped off the field, is mm-hmm. that they are flying around and there is an edge and an energy there that wasn't there before. So a lot of credit to Sonny. You credit their strength staff. You credit Joe Gillespie. You credit the rest of the defensive staff. They have that. You saw it with Quentin Johnston playing through a high ankle, and you're really going out. I mean, he's one of the differences in the game. Mm-hmm. If they don't have him, boy, TCU's offense really, really ends up struggling. So just, for as much attention as Gary got, I don't think enough people have said, hey, look, Sonny's done a lot of things that Gary didn't do the past couple of years. That doesn't take away from what Gary built there. It doesn't take away from his statue. But at the end of the day, I really feel like Sonny Dykes, and again, we've talked about the Sonny Dykes fade, et cetera. He has brought in a little bit of different formula, maybe a little different edge here. And he also has better players and better talent to work with. So just really impressive programmically, I think, all the way around to keep that edge.
I agree with that 100%. And you know my affection and affinity for Gary. A couple things I do want to point out. The story I told about Josh Newton, I don't mean that in any way, shape, form, or fashion to cast any aspersion or bad light on Louisiana Monroe, who I'm sure does everything humanly possible and within their financial power to take care of their athletes. I'm sure of that because, they have good players that have come out of there. I don't mean it. I was just highlighting the difference and showing the appreciation that one particular player has for the differences and how it's impacted him.
And they do everything they can, Reese.
Everything they can, for sure.
There's just their TV money is probably not the same. Less. They could probably make annually like less than, TCU's coordinators combined. It's just it wasn't like I was calling them Bush League or anything. Like
no, I didn't mean that.
Different financial plane. It's just simple. And they're Coach Bowden and everybody there, they work really hard to maximize what they have. But when you have limited resources, you have limited resources.
Yeah. And I guarantee you that there are people there on that staff, whether it's Terry or any of his assistants, who probably do all kinds of things personally to try to help. Oh, sure. And I don't mean anything untoward or illegal or anything like that. I'm talking about just basic things like getting food or whatever. But I just wanted to make that clear because I know people get hypersensitive about their programs and, think that I'm, picking on them or some such thing. That's not the case at all. As it pertains to the coaching change, I'm a big fan of Gary Patterson. I think he could be successful as a head coach again, as he was at TCU. But you're right to say it hasn't been the same the last few years there. And Lee Corso, who continues to recover, and I'm actually told as we record this morning, sounds and feels much better. Awesome. So we're delighted to hear that. But Lee's had one of the great analogies or lines of all time about coaching changes. He always says, when you fire a short coach, you hire a tall coach. When you fire a fat coach, you hire a skinny coach, meaning that everybody wants something a little different. And I think it's beneficial sometimes for the players to have a different approach in certain situations. And TCU had seemed to hit a plateau, a bit of a wall, a lull, and it faded, to use that term again, under Gary the last few years. And then having a different outlook and perspective on the way a team is run, on the way a program is run, an offensive approach, all of those things can be sort of reinvigorating for players. You see this in business all the time. You see it in life. And it's sort of the human nature for people to respond to a different message sometimes. And I think TCU is exhibit A of that. They are responding to a different way of doing things that Sonny has brought in. As you said, doesn't change the fact that TCU built something out of nothing under Gary Patterson, that they were undefeated Rose Bowl champs. If we'd had a 14 playoff in 2010, they would have been in it. And maybe other years too, maybe should have been in this 14 playoff in 2014 under him as well. And now a great opportunity to be in the four-team field in 2022. Does your gut tell you that even with the things that have happened around at TCU, if they were to be, And based on what we saw from Baylor the other night, it's not as if I'm sitting here picking Baylor to upset them, but we see crazy things every week. TCU as a one-loss champion of the Big 12 would still have, in my judgment, say better wins than, say, Clemson. If Clemson's a one-loss champion of the ACC, or North Carolina, if North Carolina were to be a one-loss champion in the ACC. It's going to get sticky, I know, with the whole LSU, Georgia, Tennessee conundrum, the Ohio State, Michigan thing. How would that play out? But I'm not of the opinion that it should be a situation where TCU absolutely has to be undefeated. This is not Cincinnati from last year. Now, they're non-conference. I get it. Not great. Same as Michigan. Non-conference, not great. I understand that. But I think they have enough quality wins on their resume. I'm not saying they have to make it as a one-loss champion. I am saying I don't think it's disqualifying if they were to stumble before the Big 12 championship game and then still win the Big 12.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think this year, Reese, and our listeners would know, like, is looking to maybe bend some paradigms, right? Like, you know, we sort of were talked back into Oregon being a contender after a blowout, which was something maybe that wouldn't have happened in recent years. We have two-loss LSU being a potential contender if they can go pull an upset in Atlanta and obviously take care of business against struggling Texas A&M. And
that's like kindly.
Yes. Whew, very kindly. And then, you know, like TCU right now, it would be a fascinating one-loss conference champion TCU, because there's supposed to be weight on conference champions when it's convenient, right?
Well, I wouldn't say when it's convenient, when it's similar, when a team's not unequivocally better. And to your point, that's probably this year. The only team I can look at and see right now that I would say unequivocally better is Georgia.
Yeah.
You know, I'm almost there with Ohio State, just to be candid about it, but certainly Georgia, maybe Ohio State. The rest of them, I don't see unequivocally better. So then those things should carry some weight. Head-to-head needs to carry some weight, and conference championships should.
Yeah. No, and I think if TCU stumbles at Baylor and then ends up beating Kansas State again in the Big 12 title game, say there's a myriad scenarios, but let's say it shakes out that way, I think, you know, they've got a really good case. It will be interesting, the scheduling dynamic and how that's played in this, Reese, because TCU does not have this gangbusters non-conference, but they did go on the road twice, and one of those was against a Power 5 team. And I do think the intent to schedule, and you could argue that both those games were better than Michigan's best out-of-conference game, because they had Colorado State, they had Hawaii, and then I believe they had a MAC school.
No, they had the University of Connecticut, your bowl-eligible ghost-busting Connecticut
Huskies.
That's their
best non-conference win, yes, 59-0. They beat up on old UConn. So I just think, like, boy, those are two distinctly better efforts. And did Jim Harbaugh not wanting to play UCLA, is that going to become more of the conversation here as we go forward? Because if Michigan had played and handled UCLA, or even quite frankly, handled them and lost to them and then won the conference title, like, does that it becomes interesting, because these decisions end up shaping scheduling philosophies down the road, right? There's the what if Oregon played Portland State instead of going to Atlanta to play Georgia? How would we view the Ducks differently now? And it's a fascinating question to just sort of hypothetical out. Now, I am in favor of robust non-conference schedules. Like, when I first started covering the sport, week one was boring. You know what I mean? It was like Penn State plays Toledo and wins by four. You know, it was just a lot of that. And I give the schedulers credit. I give the TV networks credit for being aggressive in sort of creating some of these games that are really exciting early in the year. And I would hate to see embracing poor opponents rewarded.
I don't think you're going to, for a number of reasons. And I wish I could remember the person who reached out to me on Twitter so I can say this. It's a Duck fan who, it shows you how everything that we say gets parsed. I have not been one of those on the what if Oregon had played Portland State bandwagon, because I'm also not a big fan of intent and scheduling, because you start going down that road, you add another qualifier, and maybe you don't consider every dimension of what led to a decision. But this Oregon fan keeps has hit me and said, Will you guys stop saying that about Portland State? We can't play Portland State. We couldn't play two of them. We already had Eastern Washington on the schedule. So they did play one, but the point, the person who sent that was sort of missing the point, because you guys were just talking about not playing Georgia, not playing the reigning national champion in their home state. You're talking about playing someone you could handle, playing a Mountain West school, a lower tier Mountain West school or something of that nature. So the point is well taken. I'm not a big fan of delving into motivation in scheduling, because there are other things, which I don't mean to put you on the spot. I don't think we've had this conversation before. Jim Harbaugh is not a guy who's going to duck anyone, I wouldn't think. I think I misspoke on the Dan Patrick show. My bigger point was that Michigan was going to be penalized for its non-conference. And I think I inverted it and said UCLA went out. I don't care who went out. They didn't play, but it was apparently Michigan's decision. What was the motivation behind that decision? Do you know that?
So they paid UCLA $1.5 million to get out of the games.
But why? When?
You know, my understanding from talking to people at UCLA, this was a couple years ago now, so it's okay. Not like they did this going into the season. I did Google and look up earlier in the year just to, as this started to percolate a little bit. But it was a pure Michigan play, because remember, UCLA kind of got stuck with a similarly lightweight non-conference schedule because of Michigan's decision. But it was communicated to me that Harbaugh basically didn't want to challenge themselves in the non-conference. And this was from the UCLA side, but that he was the instigator of this this decision. So October 25th, 2019, Michigan has terminated its home and home series when they replaced it with Hawaii and East Carolina in those two games. The release from the Michigan side in 2019 was that they did it to balance out the home schedule and guarantee seven games in Ann Arbor for each season, which, look, they must make a million plus bucks. They did pay East Carolina $1.8 million for that home game. So, look, Jim Harbaugh's one of the most competitive humans that we've seen go through modern football. And again, in 2019, when they're doing this, remember, Reese,
not very good.
Harbaugh's in a bit of a spiral. I mean, I've maintained that if the immortal Valentino Ambrosio makes a field goal when they play Rutgers in the COVID year, we may not have the Jim Harbaugh anymore, because I believe they went 2-4 in the COVID year.
They did.
And, they could have, Rutgers could have well won that game multiple times. And again, Michigan, I do credit them for this, is not a knee-jerk place. Like, it's just not a place that operates in that fashion. But, it'd be naive to think you make that decision in the middle of 2019 and there aren't competitive reasons for it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not financially motivated to give away $1.5 million to UCLA for nothing, just hand them a check, and then to get another home game and pay East Carolina, close to $2 million. And they obviously had to pay Hawaii somewhere in a pretty big range too. So do I judge Jim Harbaugh for doing that at a time when his tenure was it wasn't flatlined by any means, but he was struggling to live up to Lloyd Carr's standards, if you will. And to his credit, and to my surprise, quite frankly, they have been one of the best and most consistent teams in college football the last 2 years. They have a clear identity, and they are as solid as the day is long.
Yeah. One thing, and I do want to talk about that too, but one thing, the reason I'm against putting too much emphasis, if any, in that committee room on intent and scheduling is because, in my judgment, Michigan is going to be punished sufficiently by who they actually ended up playing. Now, as the trickle down thing, I understand that it wasn't UCLA's fault, but that's what, if Michigan loses by a field goal in a great game in Columbus, that will be the non-conference schedule without the opportunity to play UCLA will be the thing that will almost certainly keep them out of the playoff with one loss. flip it, and I think that Ohio State still has a chance. Now, I know Kirk disagrees with me on this, I think, because of the home field advantage, and that's a fair point, and it may well prove to carry the day. But to me, Ohio State is, you know, would have the one late loss to, you know, to what would then be an undefeated Michigan team. They'd have a win over Notre Dame, which is, as things keep going, it looks better and better, and they certainly pass the football judgment test. So, but I think, so there's nothing really to stick Ohio State with other than saying, well, they lost a game at home, which in this year, I mean, man, oh man, try to find the great road wins. There aren't that many of them. Mm-hmm. Washington had one the other night, but mm-hmm. there aren't that many of them. Michigan would have that. But if Michigan were to lose, then I think that non-conference albatross would be enough to keep them out. And that would probably be punishment enough. And it would probably be appropriate to be candid about it. So, you know, I think that's all really, you know, it's interesting stuff. And if we get to that, who knows? I mean, you know, maybe
that's going to be a hell of a game in Columbus.
Oh,
I mean, just, you know, I've been lucky to cover a bunch of those games over the years. And I just started kind of digging in on coaches who played one or both of them, started last night, got a couple more, this week to go on. And, you know, there is, you know, people think Ohio State has more talent. I don't think that's any great news flash, right? Mm-hmm. When you look at, you know, just some of the, but the way Michigan is playing defensively as a unit, their scheme, you know, talked to an offensive coach who played them last night, and they gushed about what Michigan does on third down. You know, the chess match with Ryan Day and Jesse Minter, that's going to be on that side of the ball, the O-line, D-lines, both sides like that. Just, again, we're going to talk about a bunch, but I'm officially fired up for that game.
Yeah. And both of them have tests of different degrees coming up this weekend. Yep. We've seen in the past great Ohio State team went into Maryland, almost messed around and lost, had to survive a 2-point conversion. This Maryland team seems to have lost its way a little bit. So I don't see that type of danger for Ohio State. And Illinois looked like a significant challenge to Michigan coming in. But the last couple of weeks, the Illini have sort of, I guess maybe the whole thing, maybe the beating Nebraska curse is alive and well or something still, because so many teams, it's weird, man. You guys can go on Twitter and find it. The teams, everybody, basically, Reader's Digest condensed version, after you finish beating Nebraska, they don't get their revenge against you then. They just get the revenge against you the rest of the season, or at least the next few weeks. You beat Nebraska, you start losing. I mean, it's really, really, really a bizarre thing. It calls to mind what they used to say, what they say about Alabama, LSU, and recent vintage. And before that, mm-hmm. when Tuberville had it rolling at Auburn, the Auburn-LSU games back in the early 2000s. And that,
you heard about the military academies sometimes, like the next week after Navy or the next week after Army, like you're just beat up and
Do it. So Tuberville told me once that when he was at Auburn that it took them a week to get over LSU. He said, we were vulnerable the next week, just mentally, physically, and everything after that type of physical game. And certainly in recent years, that's been Alabama and LSU. And I think, you know, that, I don't know, I don't think it's the same thing playing Nebraska, but it's turning into the same effect. And, you know, certainly for Michigan will have a really physical challenge, if nothing else, with Illinois coming in. Week in Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create one-of-a-kind sausage recipes. Eckrich, you do you. Let's talk a little bit about the Oregon-Washington game. That was a great win.
Great
for
one of the best games of the year.
It was tremendous. Wire. Yeah, I wasn't able to watch it in its entirety yet because I was at the TCU-Texas game, but I saw a good portion of it in the bus at one point, and then also got back to the hotel in time to see the end. And you were also gracious in keeping me up to date while I was in transit from the stadium to the hotel. But that was a great win. It was one of those things where the one thing you worried about was, you know, some of the pass defense, third down, all of that stuff from Oregon's defense. And it really came home to roost with Penix leading the nation in passing going into that game, making big plays, and then the sort of, you know, bizarre ending and that came about with Oregon trying to save itself right at the end of the game. And with that, it's thrown the whole Pac-12 race into flux.
Mm-hmm.
It's eliminated Oregon from college football playoff contention, in my judgment, even if they were to play in the Big 12 championship game and win it. But the other thing it's done is that it's put another team without a really notable win on its resume up to this point in best position out of the Pac-12, and that's USC. USC got all of this attention for Lincoln Riley coming in and Caleb Williams and Jordan Addison and all the transfers that they've had. And the Trojans have done their part. They only lost on the late two-point conversion against Utah. But the problem with USC is there's not really a notable win. I mean, what's their best win? I guess at Oregon State, who I think is a good team. It's a good, solid team, and it's a road win. So that should count. But we're going to find out about the Trojans against a disappointed, wounded UCLA team, and then against Notre Dame, which is tough, good, but limited. And that's, SC's in decent shape here coming down the stretch.
They are in decent shape. So I called around a little bit about Oregon last week, caught some USC shrapnel. That's just from talking to different coordinators out west, because there's obviously some overlap in how they play. And boy, were people underwhelmed by USC's defense. Like that there was just not a lot of, like, structurally unsound was one word that came to mind by one of the coaches. It was just not, there was not like a, now look, Caleb Williams is unbelievable, and nobody is certain denying what their skill level is there. But they play three consecutive quality opponents, right? UCLA is a sound quality opponent, even though they lost Arizona the other night. And then obviously Notre Dame, look, Drew Pine is not going to go possession for possession. Larry Bird, Dominique Wilkins with Caleb Williams, right? That's not going to happen. But there is at least a roadmap for Notre Dame to play smash mouth, which USC may struggle with some, and give them fits and give them a test a little bit. So those are interesting tests. And then the Pac-12 title game, which I would think the odds on favorites is they play Oregon, correct? Which who they haven't played this year?
Oregon,
could be Washington.
Yeah. It could be Utah. Remember, Utah's only got one conference loss in the old head-to-head on USC. Utah's got Oregon this week.
True.
Yeah, yeah, so I think you're looking at I should have the scenarios broken down already, but basically I don't think it's too terribly complicated right now. I think that Oregon game gave USC a clear path in, and Oregon is either going to get its second conference loss or Utah is going to get its second conference loss. So I would say the winner of that game is in really good shape. Of course, then you have to factor in that UCLA has the tiebreaker head-to-head over Utah, but not Oregon. there are some combinations and permutations that will be at play based on the results of the game this weekend.
Washington is 5-2, but they still theoretically have a shot.
One or two losses, you're still in it, right?
Yes,
in the Pac-12.
Exactly. Yeah. So Oregon State down, and Oregon State's had a heck of a year. They're 7-3, 4-3 in the league. But yes, it's look, the Pac-12, give them a lot of credit. Like that league has elevated itself this year. It has been a fun league. It is kind of filled with stars again. And look, Penix and Bo Nix were imported stars, but that's what happens when you go hire good coaches, is good talent follows them. I mean, really, Caleb Williams too, right? So the three defining players in the Pac-12 this year are all guys who played elsewhere last year. So yeah, it has been a lot more enjoyable to watch West Coast football. I think they have six ranked teams right now. I saw on Sunday, and again, we root for a vibrant, healthy college football from coast to coast. And so it's nice to see the Pac-12 in the thick of the playoff conversation. Not are they out on September 10th, like we've been talking about in previous years. So that will be a fun conclusion. And let's hope that there's some CFP stakes in however the Pac-12 race does shake out.
I think there's a pretty good chance of that. If you had to bet a nickel, to use our buddy Gene Wojciechowski's idea for peace, if you had to bet a nickel or a week's paycheck, whichever one you, let's say a week's paycheck, but like put a little stake in the game, Who is the Pac-12 champion on selection day, and are they being considered for the playoff spot?
I think it's Utah, and no.
If I had to bet a nickel, that's where I would go to. I mean, now look, man, they've got to win in Autzen after Oregon just lost, you know, a rivalry game. So they're running into a buzzsaw there. But that's what I go with too. I think Utah will get there, and I think they'll win the game, and they'll be just on the outside, and they'll go back to the Rose Bowl. That's my guess, my best prediction. So where does SC lose? Do they lose to UCLA, or do they lose and not make it, or do they lose to Utah again in the Pac-12 championship game?
I think they lose to Utah again, which would make for a heck of a Pac-12 championship game
with some high stakes.
Oh, the regular season one was awesome.
What, I mean, great games of the year.
It was a great
the 10 game. Best games of the year.
Yeah. Great game. Just I'll sign up to see that again. And
yeah, and if I'm listened wrong, to that game.
I don't know if you remember this, Reese. I listened to that game driving home to Boston after we left Knoxville, and I toggled between the SC broadcast and the Utah broadcast. It was just a fun night. Like, I love listening to games on radio. I know that makes me like old and antiquated, but I just like the. You know, you listen to the Nebraska game on Sirius, and like you see that, hear the farm commercials, and then you listen to the, you know, that it's just like it was one of the cool, you know, it was such a good game, and stakes were so high, and you know, obviously came down to last play. So anyway, that was one of my sort of favorite consumption of the game moments of the year.
No, I like listening to the games on the radio too, and I think we talked about this, the ESPNU channel on Sirius,
channel
84. Not to give them a plug until they reignite my free subscription. So I keep making these appearances for them, and my radios are dead. So they've got to get on that like right now, Mike.
I pay for mine.
No, so, you should start making some appearances. That's like, I mean, they get off cheaply because I mean. A little baseline subscription for making a weekly appearance on there. That's pennies on the dollar for them, Pete. With you, you're the authority. Go in there and get that stuff going.
But, my pet peeve is you can't listen to that on a plane. So sometimes the internet on a plane isn't good enough to get a YouTube TV feed or whatever, but you can listen to the radio. So that's like a great way. If you're in the air for an hour, just like they hop through games, they're like, oh, third goal at Tennessee. We'll go down to the call on
really
the
good.
Radio network. And then it's like, oh, San Diego State's lined up for a game winning field goal. Let's go out to, you know, the mountain. You know, so I enjoy just sort of following that way. And it gives you, because the radio guys know so much and do so much prep. They really give you like an extra level of, you know, the extra level of detail and color and such. So, but when you're, once you hit 10,000 feet, ain't no serious up there.
No, the streaming has gotten better. If you get on the planes, particularly Delta and American, some of the service, now some of it's still awful, but there are some of the higher speed ones now. The $5 one, the one that says $5 streaming, that one's fast, and you can even get some video sometimes. And American has a pretty good one where you go on your device and go on Wi-Fi and entertainment, and they have several channels available to you to be able to just watch through their service, and you can actually see some games. So it's not bad.
People wonder what we talk about on Saturdays.
Well, they like. I'm told that in these podcasts that they like some of the behind the scenes stuff.
Sure.
So that's what we do. I'll give you an example. I told you a great day for me after the show is to be able to go on the College Game Day bus. Yeah. Five monitors, sit there, watch, pop up different games, keep up with everything. Well, Saturday wasn't bad either. The bus had to get on its way to Bozeman. You know, that's a long drive. So Matt, our sensational bus driver, had to take off. So instead, I went back to the hotel, had screen three devices up. And so you sort of had the same thing too. That's a good day too. And then you hop in the car and go to the game and realize that, that this is a spoiled, wonderful existence that we have to be able to go and keep up with all these games and watch. And you come back and watch the end and stay there and watch Jaden Delora weave his magic against Chip Kelly. And great win for Jed Fish, by the way, who's done a really, really good job. They're fun to watch on offense, at least. And put a crimp in Chip's plans this year. So plenty of upsets, a lot of fun to be able to do that.
What are you looking forward to in Bozeman, Reese? And this is an open call for, I've actually been to Bozeman before, but open call for any suggestions, any like background history in the rivalry, hit me up on social media, shoot an email, whatever it is. I'm fired up. It's just going to be so different. And the scene there is going to be surreal from all accounts. What are you fired up about?
I love to go new places with the big scenes, and because they have been lobbying so hard to get us to this rivalry game over the last few years. And we did a great essay on it that we're going to update and run, I think at least the early part of the plans, to familiarize people with why this is important. Both of these programs have been really good at the FCS level, obviously. So I'm looking forward to the scene. I'm looking forward to seeing how we respond to the elements, because that's going to be much like a game. That's going to be part of the story, and it's going to be part of the fun. I'm no big fan of cold weather, but for whatever reason, I'm looking forward to the show in those elements in that morning, because I think they're really going to be proud to show things off. And I've already had a couple of people reach out to me from that area, from the Big Sky, from Montana State, and, you know, invite me to join them, and I'm going to go soak it up. You know how I am. I tend to, especially on Fridays, kind of get in the silo, because you want to do the best job you possibly can on the show and be completely prepared. Spend a lot of time in my hotel room on the road. But I feel like I'll be doing myself and the show and the whole event a disservice if I approach it totally that way. Still going to be the same level of preparation, all that kind of thing. You can't let that slide. That's job number one. But I also feel like I owe it to myself and the show and the experience and the whole thing to go out and soak this up. So I'm open to those recommendations too. I can't wait to get out there and have a look at it and see what kind of reception they give us, and to tell some stories. And we're obviously going to cover the day, but it's an odd day in terms of schedule for, you know, the rest of the games. There aren't blockbusters out there necessarily. So it's a good day to do that, to talk about games, look for upsets, do some big picture discussions, and still celebrate all levels of the sport. And one of the great rivalries that's often not on the edge of the consciousness of the average college football fan.
Yeah. Well, the good news for us is that we will have plenty of prep time on the flight, because it's not a short flight.
It is not.
No complaints though. But yeah, let's get a bison ribeye on Saturday night. Let's have the good people tell us the best place to go grab some sort of local hunk of meat.
I'm totally in on that.
Yeah.
And by the way, the bison is a fine cut of meat too.
I've never had bison.
Well, that's what we're gonna do when we get out there. Then, you know, we'll have to make sure that we do that before. Yeah.
Send us the best bison ribeye place in Bozeman. We're trusting you, trusted listeners.
What's the coldest game you can recall being at?
So I have a very clear answer to this. December 7th, 2003, Colgate 28, Western Illinois 27, in a blizzard in Hamilton, New York. Marissa Dowling, our ace researcher, will appreciate this story. Colgate stuns Western Illinois, who they had no business beating, in front of a robust 5,287. It snowed 8 inches from kickoff to end game. 8 inches over a four-hour period, which is like just a football game played in a flat blizzard. And all Western Illinois speed was negated. Colgate somehow gutted out a win. The students, many of whom were bare-chested for the game, which was impressive, rolled out, probably with a little liquid courage, grabbed the goalposts, and then they haul them up the street at Colgate. And I don't know if you've ever been to beautiful Hamilton, New York, but there's a big pond right on the cusp of campus. And after I filed my story, I drove back to Syracuse, where I'd flown out of, and the goalposts are bobbing up and down in the lake. I mean, it snowed like, and again, I went to Syracuse and I live in Boston, so I'm not exactly a prude when it comes to snow. I was like white knuckle the whole way back. It was a flat blizzard. So I guess temperature probably didn't matter as much. I did go to like the coldest NFL playoff game ever, Patriots, Tennessee. I covered it as a stringer for the New York Times. It was like epically frigid, and I don't know if it still is the coldest one, but that was, those are two of them. But yes, you don't learn a lot about math at Syracuse, but they teach you to layer up. So I will be layered up. I will look like a little snowman. The only worry is if I'm going to split my pants because I have too many long johns on.
You might have a run for your money for the coldest one coming up on Saturday with Montana.
Let's go.
And Montana State. Can't wait to get there. Going to be fun. We'll be back on Wednesday with the podcast. Look ahead to some of the games this week. Also, perhaps talk some big picture issues with Heisman Trophy. More on the playoff and reaction to the college football playoff rankings, which will come out again on Tuesday night. Once again, just want to reiterate our hearts, our thoughts, prayers, and condolences going out to everyone associated with the tragedy at the University of Virginia. Our deepest sympathies to all of those involved. Thank you for listening. We encourage you to download this wherever you like to get your podcast.